Hello, I'm Alistair Benn, and welcome to this week's Reaction podcast. I'm joined by Maggie Pagano, Executive Editor of Reaction, and Ian Martin, our editor. If you like what you hear, do please subscribe to read all our stuff on our website. That's www.reaction.life. We've got loads of great content on there, a weekend supplement that goes out every Saturday, and all the coverage of what's going on in the election and broader political trends. So, Maggie, you were telling me that your blood pressure went through the roof yesterday. Why?
I'm afraid it did. I was heading for NHS, actually, and the outrageous mendacity, barefaced lies that Jeremy Corbyn has presented with this document.
Come off the fence, Maggie.
I am off the fence and on the tight road, actually. And I think I've talked to a lot of medics, a lot of consultants, a lot of people from the inside, life science, former ministers, and there is absolutely no plan whatsoever to privatise. And what I think the Conservative government need to do is hit back, potentially even sue them for slander, whether that's possible. But longer term, I'm wondering if there isn't a way, because the NHS, I mean, I don't know about Germany, France, Italy, do they have these slanging matches about their healthcare systems? I mean, it's unparalleled here.
Well, they don't have health systems that are the envy of the world.
Well, yes.
It features, I think, in European election campaigns, but it is more...
Not on this scale.
It doesn't come down as to, you know, we're going to have the Anglo-Saxon model of healthcare. It's much more technical.
So people
are annoyed. For example, during the heat wave in the summer in France, people were troubled by how poor the health coverage was or why so many people were dying. But I don't think it was a big political football.
But the point I wanted to continue to make was that I think it's tragic that this debate happens during the election. And there has to be, we've talked about this before, a way of depoliticising it. And maybe, I mean, my own idea a few years ago was to you create an independent body, a bit like the Bank of England, where you have Simon Stevens is the NHS head of England, he's at the top, and then you have cross-party working parties to which the NHS is accountable, so their budget is set in line with play. Or somebody suggested to me this morning that you write it into the constitution, our unwritten constitution, that the concept of free access to the NHS is enshrined in the constitution. You've got to find a way of sort of, you know, extinguishing. We're wasting so much time. And it's not even a healthy debate. The real debate is how do we fund an ageing population with multiple chronic illnesses? That's the real debate.
Yeah, and in a highly socialised system, how do you have enough social solidarity to make sure people are willing to pay for it? Because that seems to me the fundamental difference between a lot of debates we have in the UK compared to the continent.
Didn't you feel it was interesting, though, that Labour did this on Wednesday, so produced this 471-page dossier and have Labour activists who are doctors and nurses who were at the press conference. Did it not smack a bit of desperation that they can see what's happening to them in the campaign, potentially? And also, did it not also strike you that it didn't really connect in the way that it usually would in a general election campaign?
I think you're right. And I think coming so close, I mean, I wonder whether that press conference at 10 o'clock yesterday had been planned before, or whether post the chief rabbi's article in the Times and the whole anti-Semitism, they brought it forward. I think they had it there as a smoking gun waiting for a really bad day. That's what I felt. Because actually, the anti-Semitism and the NHS together are taking the press scrutiny away from what we should be looking at, which is Corbyn's economic plans. I think you're absolutely right here.
Because it didn't really bear much, it didn't really survive scrutiny, because the moment that you got into actually reading the document, which quite a lot of it, or the substance, had been around for a while.
Well,
anyway,
it was leaked on Reddit at the end of October, so it's been there for a month, and no one's used it.
And surprise, surprise, civil servants have meetings with their counterparts all the time about... Liam Fox in 2017 has told some civil servants to explore potential pathways to maybe there'd be a trade deal in 10 years' time, maybe we can work out. And it's just so banal as to be of no news worth. I mean, that's hilarious... commentators on some bits of the more immature left saying it shows that mainstream journalists like Nora Koonsberg or whatever are not really following the story because they didn't report on this a month ago when it was on Reddit. Well, because it's just a complete non-story, no fabrication.
I think the NHS was mentioned four times in the entire 400 pages and only about this access to drugs, which is completely normal, commonplace, and you would hope they would be discussing.
But where it works for Labour, potentially, is that they are in a hole.
Yeah.
And you look at the polls, they need some way of putting on an extra 2, 3, 4 points. So that's really what it's about. It's kind of a concession of defeat in terms of winning the election. But if they can narrow the Tory lead from about 11, 12, 10, roughly where it is now, somewhere in that zone, if they can get that down to 6 or 7 on the back of creating a panic about the NHS and related issues, or sending a signal to traditional Labour voters who are thinking about deserting the Labour Party and voting Tory, then it's worth it. That's what that is what
that's
it's about. It's about just unlocking a little quite a significant part of the electorate that is proving reluctant to vote Labour. Now it may be that doesn't work because those voters are furious with the Labour Party and not voting Labour for all sorts of reasons. It's much deeper than Labour haven't had a strong line of attack on the NHS. Yeah. Here it is. I'll now switch back. For some of them, it's to do with Brexit. For others, it's to do with Corbyn being seen as simply unpatriotic, its sort of general sense of decay, and Labour being seen as an increasingly sort of London-dominated party. But that's what I think what they're trying to do, and it might work.
What do you think of their latest plans, talked about this afternoon, that they're now going to go out to the Labour Leave seats and campaign for Leave, and even Corbyn's going to. So in some Remain seats, they'll be saying Remain and in Leave.
I think it is a gift to the Tories, and it is you get moments in campaigns where, of course, this could be wrong, and Labour do close the gap, and there's a hung parliament. We'll talk a bit about the Times mega poll, if you like, which predicts a majority of, doesn't predict, these things never predict, but it says that if there was an election now, there would be a Tory majority of, I think it says 68. But you get these break moments in campaigns where parties try and change strategy. It's an indication that they really know that they're in trouble. And it just doesn't seem plausible, the idea that they're now going to, after everything that's happened with the Labour front bench and Labour becoming the party of Remain-ish and an ultra-soft Brexit, and then Corbyn saying that he will be neutral in a referendum if it happens, to suddenly, with 2 weeks to go, to start to try and put up some more Leave voices in northern constituencies and then expect voters in significant numbers to switch back to Labour seems to me to treat people as idiots. It then also is clearly then noticed by Remainers in the southern seats and in London seats where Labour needs to win and is in trouble for other reasons.
And closely connected to that is the immigration question. When he said on Andrew Neil, the thing that probably harms him politically was when he said there will be a lot of movement.
Hasn't been picked up a lot, actually, Alistair,
But for a variety of reasons, and I don't think anti-Semitism resonates with the British public in large parts of the country because it's a tiny minority.
And it's unfamiliar to them. They don't know
exactly. The thing resonates when it's about, I think, much more about patriotism and about his clearly his long-held distrust of the British state, things like that. Although obviously the anti-Semitism stuff is shocking, I don't think it's actually the thing that damages them most. I think on it's that inability to square the immigration circle. And I think there is an element with the dynamic that Ian talks about there, that they want to just edge it up so they can get to a hung parliament. I think it's actually much more nihilistic than that. Since 1983, there's been a mythology on the left that 83, with the most radical manifesto in post-war history, was a high point in Labour radicalism, and it managed to attract 9 million votes or something. I mean, Thatcher got many more. But it's portrayed as, if the Falklands hadn't happened, this manifesto, because it managed to acquire this enormous popular mandate.
As Tony Benn said the morning afterwards, 9 million people, I think it's 9 million, you're right, voted for true socialism for the first
time. Exactly, but the manifesto, I just thought, was so clearly, I mean, this is Philip Collins' line, it was so mad and
this
fantastical.
Manifesto.
Yeah,
this manifesto.
Which was much more radical than, let's remember, in 2017, it was very close to what Ed Miliband had proposed. There was nowhere near as much spending proposed. It was more modest than some of his aspirations. This manifesto is a proper, full-on,
this,
you know,
is a
we're going
to state takeover.
Exactly, with everything that would entail. And if you can get, you know, healthily above 30% of people to vote for it, through shimmying it with the NHS or whatever, then you can make the argument that the Corbyn project was not defeated at the ballot box. It was genuinely popular. It was just the media that broke it down. It was the Jews who stopped it. It was
the money men.
And it was the bankers and the Tory and the nasty Tory party who used Brexit to deceive the working classes against their own interests. So I think there's it's more than literally calculation. I think it's this mentality, which has been there in the years of when Labour was defeated again and again by the Tories, it was all part of the mythology. And I think we're seeing something similar happen now. And it is I just think that is a dreadful, dreadful position to take on politics, because you allow people you've allowed the Tory party to become a complacent mess and yet still defy political gravity. And that is completely unforgivable in the terms of how you think about how politics resets, how it changes, and how it evolves.
And it fits with the John McDonnell view, which is that the current thinking is of people involved. This is a movement.
Yes.
This is not a democratic party that puts its views, but a movement that will grow, which is quite dangerous.
Yeah, it's in the office, it's in the streets, it's in the offices,
it's activism,
it's in everything, and
could lead to violence.
Yeah.
But then this is going to collide post the election. We're assuming, for the purposes of this discussion, that the Tories are on course for some sort of majority, 68, according to that poll we mentioned a minute ago, or if the polls narrow, it could be somewhere between 10 and 30. So just assuming that that's the case, that is going to then raise the question, which we've talked about before, about what happens to the Labour Party. There's going to then be a collision between the movement that you describe and then the need for the desire for non-Tory people in Britain to have some form of outlet
representation
or some vehicle that can take on the Tory Party. Otherwise, you get the Tory Party in office in perpetuity.
Yeah,
but there doesn't seem... All I see at the moment is lots of depressed Remainers who bought this idea of depressed middle class Remainers who bought the idea of a Lib Dem revival, a breakthrough, a realignment, and which sounds ludicrous now, around Jo Swinson and change something, whatever it's called now, all seems like sort of ancient history. That, if the polls are correct, isn't happening. So where does all of that energy go, and what political direction does it... we've talked in the past about the possibility of retaking or reclaiming the Labour Party, but John McDonnell and his heirs are not going to give it up.
Yeah, and it's because of the Labour Party processes. It's very hard once you have total control of things like the NEC.
And the voting system. What about that actually the rejigging happens in the Lib Dem Party? Since Swinson is kicked out, so the Chukwuemanas and Luciana Berger's They, that group, take control, greater control, and then you could see the Labour moderates, the Yvette Coopers and others, maybe switching over. Maybe you rename it. Yeah, and you call it, then it becomes a Social Democrat Party. But maybe then, it can't be done in the Labour Party, that's so tribal.
But then the backbone of the Liberal Democrats, with its quixotic geographic roots, it's a weird blend of a party. Those people who've been through the good times and the difficult times and have been through coalition and are interested in the Liberal Democrats as a vehicle in local government, and they take the long view of the Liberal story. Why on earth should they turn over their party to a bunch of carpetbaggers who then couldn't even win their seats? I mean, it may be that the polls are wrong and a few of the new arrivals in Lib Dems do actually win their seats. Mm.
Yeah.
But I don't see them saying, well, that's fine.
Yeah.
Labour moderates, welcome aboard, despite the fact that the first wave wasn't successful, and will allow you to rename the party. I would say the Liberal Democrats will just go on being the Liberal Democrats. Jo Swinson will probably resign and be replaced by someone else, and they'll do what they always do, which is painstaking rebuilding. If they only end up with a few more seats than they have at the moment. It's not that long ago they were talking about, they were revising down their expectations to 60 seats. I mean, there's 10 days to go, and it could change again. Of course it could, but it seems highly unlikely. So you have a very depressed Liberal Democrat grouping. You have a Labour Party which has been purged to a large extent of moderates in the top, but you can't have the Tories in charge forever, or the Tories unchallenged. English and British politics doesn't work like that.
And it sends politics mad eventually.
Yeah,
but it's what happened with Thatcher era. It was the Tories were in power just far too long, and it created a series of cultural ripples in our culture which are still pretty poisonous. In Scotland, it created a massive demand for a very vicious form of nationalism.
Mm.
In England, it's created, for good reasons in some parts of the country, a massive mythology on the left of the Tories being evil. But intrinsically evil, not doing evil things. Everyone can do evil things, but intrinsically evil. And I think
and that virtue only sits on the left.
Yeah. But in other political systems, if the opposition isn't doing too badly, in France, for example, you can have cohabitation, where if the new president hasn't done well enough, he has to share power.
Mm.
Or there can be someone who runs for president from a
different party.
Different.
Well, it's
could
our voting
get energy
system,
from
I
somewhere
guess.
Else.
It is our first past the post, isn't it?
Can I just test your assumptions? I know I'm obsessed at the moment with the polling and with sort of short term movements in a very kind of techie way. But can I just test your assumptions on that polling? I keep mentioning the mega poll. Do you think that is correct, or do you think it's an overstatement of the situation, or is it all set up for complacent Tories to get a shock?
I sort of tend to agree with Dom Cummings's analysis, which is that it's still going to be a knife edge. I was quite positive, optimistic last week, and 30 majority, And I'm not saying I don't think that anymore, but I think it is tighter. They say oppositions don't win, governments lose. And at the moment, I feel like the Tories have lost. They're not out there. People will vote for the least worst option. Why would you vote for the Tories now? Forget Brexit, because actually I don't think this is about Brexit anymore.
You don't?
No, I don't. No. I think it will be in those high leave, but I think most of the people, I don't think it's as important. Right. Otherwise, Lib Dems would be doing better, actually.
But it's more
because there's so many people in the middle who voted Remain. Why aren't they flocking to them? So I think it's tight.
Look, in Scotland, there's so many marginals which are still in the polling, still look pretty tight.
Yeah.
Same in the so-called red wall seats. Yeah. It's all within a margin of 5%.
And the 10 Lib Dem Tory seats where it's...
But it does chime with what I've been hearing from all kinds of people, that the Tories are getting into places that they are that they
wouldn't normally
haven't won for 100 years, haven't won for 50 years.
Yeah.
And that Labour messages are not resonating the way they did in 2017, because it's Corbyn is no longer
the Messiah.
So he's no longer some new flashy person. He has been inflicted with serious political damage over the last couple of years. I assume the NRP poll was essentially correct, but with caveats, which I think is the best way to take polling.
Events.
But I think the Tories have.
Also, we had Nate Silver to tweet about how he thought it was bollocks.
What a tweet! I still find myself astonished at that bloke after 2016.
Even
carries on in the way he does.
Even Aaron Bastani, who is a real Corbyn fan, replied saying, "No, I think the poll's actually pretty accurate."
did he?
Yeah.
Oh, he must have been really.
I think we are in trouble.
I mean, we'll see. I mean, I think actually I disagree slightly, Maggie. I think that the I think the Tories have run really quite a sophisticated, targeted campaign where, I mean, I can see that some of their supporters are annoyed that they're not out there punching and you know, hitting the Marxists harder and. All of that stuff. I think with the voters that they're trying to get, I don't think that necessarily works. And I think that the deal is almost done with those voters. They see Corbyn as someone who is fundamentally unpatriotic.
Yeah.
Tories got a lot of them in 2017, and they now need some more to tip those seats over. But that they see Corbyn as fundamentally unpatriotic, can't be Prime Minister. A large swathe of that vote just quite likes the fact that Boris is insurgent, although he's establishment, he appears somehow to be anti-establishment as well, and he breaks the rules. And
he's just a very British character in lots of ways, isn't he? Sort of not pantomime, well, cross-pantomime and friendly.
Yeah, there's a
relatable.
There's a class component to it as well. So I think they've targeted that and the seats that they need to win really quite ruthlessly. It could go wrong. It is vulnerable to a tightening of the lead. But I was looking back at some numbers for a piece I was writing for the Times about what happens after the election and how I think there's a backlash coming. If the Tories win, it'll be seen as them having won because Corbyn was so unacceptable. And there's this pent-up anger. But if you look back at the polling numbers, the Tories, as recently as June, polled 17% with YouGov. Now, they tended to poll in that period around between 20 and 24, 25. That's where they were with Theresa May in the spring and then the early summer. And it is common to criticise political parties for being incompetent or not spotting the danger or whatever, but it is fascinating the way in which they did get a move on. They did change their leader. They've been very opportunistic in terms of ideological cross-dressing, the policies that they've picked. They've reorganised themselves centrally in CCHQ terms. They've appear to have deployed the money that they've raised quite effectively. And they've gone from a situation where they were sub 20% of the vote in the aftermath of failing to deliver Brexit, where it looks as though they're going to get somewhere around 40%, and they're on target at the moment for a majority that's bigger than anything they've had since 1987. So I think they're nervous, and Cummings is right toward them not to be complacent.
Yes, that's what I was really saying. Never be complacent.
Yeah,
I think that's more the point.
Yeah.
And, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen in the next 10 days.
Yeah.
Not that I think, like, you know, people are making a lot of the fact that Boris might not be interviewed by Andrew Neil, you know, when he will be put under great pressure and asked about his private life, things like that. Personally, I don't even think that would make much difference.
Yeah.
I think it's the sort of thing where people get very angry until it happens or it doesn't happen, and then people forget about it. But maybe the SNP should stand south of the border. That would resolve the centrist problem. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon is very well liked by
I think she's admired. I mean, a lot of Tourists not that by I me. Know are saying that if only we had her on our side.
But she's portrayed,
my goodness.
I know, because she's so cunning. She's just brilliant under pressure.
Do you think?
But she's a political
one. She's having an absolutely dreadful election.
Even though Neil got her, sliced her in salami slices for over the NHS, actually, she just comes back. She doesn't give up.
She loves the cuss and
where.
Trust.
She finds that confidence.
But she actually relishes it. Like, you can tell she's just like, here's Andrew Neil giving
me
giving me a real thrilling.
You watch her body language. It's like, give me more. Yeah. You know?
I'm gonna have to disagree with you again. And okay, I'm biased as a unionist, I think she's not struggling in this campaign, obviously, because those who, she's a bit like Boris in that those who like her and love her really love her.
Yeah.
But the story of the campaign in Scotland is seems to be the Tory fight back, which is fascinating, which the Tories went into it thinking that they could hold maybe 4 or 5 or 6 seats, and they're now quite optimistic about holding more than 10. And maybe
is Ruth playing a bigger role?
No, not at all. It's beyond all that. It's Ruth who in politics moves on very quickly.
Wow.
A lot of those Tory voters are people who would have, I'm not saying they don't like or acknowledge Ruth Davidson, but she's not there. She is out doing a bit of campaigning, and they don't really have a leader. But it is about quite middle of the road, small business Scotland that is quite liberal conservative, rallying around Save the Union and it being a referendum on Nicola Sturgeon. So if you don't like Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland, you really, really don't like Nicola
Sturgeon.
Don't
get me wrong. She
drives
me
insane,
but I think she's a brilliant operator. But did you see the Labour candidate in East Renfrew has had to stand down, and they're not putting up, if I pronounce that correctly?
It's quite difficult.
And they're not putting up? They're not putting up a candidate?
It's quite difficult to keep track with this election of who's being withdrawn and standing down for saying something terrible on social media. But I hadn't seen that.
I saw that on a tweet.
But so the story in Scotland is really, can the Nationalists began really by wanting to get about 50 seats? And the question is now is can the Tories effectively keep them at around 40 or below, which the Tories would regard as a very good result. So it's not quite turning out in the way that the Nationalists had planned. However, it is, as we said last time, it's a marginal country, not unimportant. It is marginal in the sense that it's fascinating because it has so many marginal seats within it. Seats where you sort of think they used to be really solid Labour, and then now the Nationalists have two or three majority of, 1,600, 1,700 in a seat in Edinburgh, like Leith, which is becoming Edinburgh North and Leith. I can't remember what the constituency is called, but that's now a three-way marginal as Leith becomes more gentrified. So you're all
it's
manner
my
of
old
weird.
Constituency.
It's your old constituency.
That's where I grew up.
I mean, the SNP will probably win that because the Labour vote will go down and it will split a bit to the Tories on the Unionist front and it'll go to the SNP, but the Tories will probably end up there in second place.
What would it take for Sturgeon to be tipped, to be pushed out as leader of a minority government?
Well, no,
that's form of coalition.
That's not that. No. Oh, do you mean next time?
Yeah.
So next time, well, the question then is whether Sturgeon will, and we can't really. The Salmond trial is live and will come up early next year. So it depends on the outcome of what happens in the court case. If the Nationalists don't get a kick or a boost out of this, and of course the activists want this to be such an overwhelming result for the SNP, and it still might be that she can instantly turn around to say it's Boris Johnson and say, well, you've now got to give me an independence referendum. He then won't, but she would use it to campaign on and then use it as a springboard for the elections in for the next Holyrood elections. But
next
they
year or the year after?
That's the
year
after
year
next.
After,
but they then become quite difficult if the SNP has had to change leader because of the fallout from the Salmond trial. So things are not straightforward for the SNP, but I stress again, they could get anywhere between 38, 39 seats and 50, depending on the dispensation of the vote and depending on you know how some fairly weird marginals work out. But as it stands at the moment, the story is of the Tories surging a little bit in Scotland and it making it really, really difficult to predict.
I love the, I mean, just a different point really, I love the brass neck qualities when she said, when Neil asked her, well, if we don't leave the European Union, how can you argue that we should still have a Scottish referendum as a price for a coalition? Because there has been, as she said a couple of years ago, if there was a material change in the constitutional settlement, then would have to be another referendum, and that could be Brexit.
Yeah.
Her answer is it's amazing, really, to say. She said, well, it's about the whole tone of politics. Yeah. And the last few years have shown that it's clearly anti-Scottish in tone. But what I'm saying is such a contrast to Corbyn's performance, because it was like he didn't have a belief that he could make the argument against Neil. Mm-hmm. It was like he'd lost. It was really.
I'm not saying he was drugged, right? So yeah. I'm not saying that he looked like someone who, yes, looked soporific. Yeah. He looked like someone who'd been trained not to get angry.
Yeah. Did you see there was one moment he got very angry, his hands came up.
Can I finish?
He said, yeah.
Very partridge.
And he kept having to suppress it. So the media training had clearly been about, you're going to come under sustained pressure here on anti-Semitism and on the economic numbers, and just try and stay calm. And that staying calm just turned into him being almost, I mean, just look.
Can you imagine McDonald sitting in his living room where he does media appearances from quite regularly with his funny flock curtains? Can you imagine him just sitting there? I mean, McDonald would have handled that interview
very differently.
Infinitely better, because he is able to kind of engage and he treats it almost seriously, which is his.
Well,
strength.
I think he's interested.
A serious person.
He's interested in the ideas, but I mean, McDonnell is the one who's running that shadow team anyway. And I suspect what I felt by watching that interview was that Corbyn has never been challenged in his life over these big issues. He's sort of led a student life, either in unions, a bit like Swinson. They've never had to be tested, and because the left have always felt and are able to portray that they have a monopoly on compassion and virtue, it almost goes unchallenged when they say, we care about food bank, we care about, but how would you pay it? Oh, don't worry about that, So this is sort of almost like the first time that they've had a sustained, and your point that you wrote about, the economic illiteracy is beyond parody, actually, isn't it?
There was I had to watch back the section on
the debt.
On nationalisation and government debt, where he clearly had never considered it, or he just took it for granted that when you nationalise something, as he used this phrase, Andrew Neil, you don't often see being astonished, you're temporarily
gobsmacked.
Stunned, because he said, right, we'll nationalise it, but we then just swap the shares for
gilts,
government bonds.
For bonds,
And Andrew Neil said, well, but that's debt, you have to borrow to fund that. And Corbyn just seemed perplexed by it. And then when you got into Doug, Andrew Neil kept going back on the on the detail, and I've long disagreed obviously with Jeremy Corbyn or the McDonnell analysis on economics, but you know with John McDonnell that he knows how bonds work, and that it is a debt.
I think Corbyn just mumbled something about it sort of gets interest.
He said it gets interest and it attracts a benefit.
And what he said was it becomes an investment.
Yes.
But he doesn't realise we need investors to buy those bonds. Yeah. But if they don't see a return, they're not going to invest in great UK PLC.
Yes.
Are they? Especially if you've got exchange controls.
Precisely. But when we used to write critically of Gordon Brown or other senior Labour figures because of their attitude to public spending or the size of the state or the way in which they'd rescued the banks or the particular model that they'd devised for that. You did so knowing. I mean, now realising
how to... Like a intellectual giant, wasn't he? And Alistair Darling, all these characters, but you sort of say, come back, please.
Exactly, but at no point did it, was there any doubt that they understood
Or someone like Ed Balls.
Understood the underlying fundamentals. Of course, Ed Balls is very smart economically. I mean, you disagree with the...
Endogenous
prognosis.
And his five tests, of course, would keep us out of Europe. Can I ask you both a question? What do you think Gordon Brown, Ed Balls, Yvette Cooper, even Keir Starmer, what are they thinking when they watch him being interviewed? And what are they saying on the doorstep when they're campaigning? Because they cannot believe in this programme. Are they really so... Maybe they're stunned themselves, or maybe they're so tribal.
I mean, I can't speak for any of those individuals, and quite a few of those individuals are no longer campaigning.
I assume Ed Balls is campaigning for Yvette Cooper. You would think so, and Gordon Brown, come on, he must, you know, he has his whole Labour friendship groups and community.
I mean, Theresa May's out campaigning for the Conservatives.
Exactly.
So, yeah, of course, there's a bit of that. Well, the Labour moderates seem to be divided, not bitterly, but just a bit confused, between those who are obviously still in there and fighting seats and waiting to see what happens and trying not to be asked the question, do you think that this man, Jeremy Corbyn, should be Prime Minister or not, which Jess Phillips always says is a ridiculous question, but strikes me, Jess Phillips having written a book calling out bullshit in politics. I mean, I think it's a fairly elementary question. Do you think this guy should be Prime Minister? And lots of Labour moderates just try and dodge that in the hope that something else will turn up. Older Labour moderates, conversations I've had in the last 6 months or a year, it's about hoping that the defeat, if it is a defeat, is absolutely crushing. Because what would be a disaster for Labour if the moderates are going to attempt to take it back and it would take 5 to 10 years to do? They need this to be a... You know, Labour to go down to, I don't know, 200 or below, sub 200, and this agenda, with the caveat that Alistair said that the left will still see this no matter what the result, is a great endorsement of the manifesto. To reclaim Labour and start rebuilding from a moderate mainstream centre left perspective, you need them to get an absolute thrashing. So that's where I think the moderates are just watching and waiting and to see what happens. What I don't have a sense of is whether they have the stomach for the fights longer term, whether they're actually really up for it.
Spending their entire life.
In the same way.
Stella Creasy's just had children, a child, you know, that younger generation that came in, are they going to want to stick around?
But we said it last week. Years? That was great. Corbyn's extraordinary. It's probably one of his very, I mean, I don't want to be mean, but he doesn't have that many qualities, but he is incredibly stubborn and dedicated. And he spent his whole life just relentlessly going to meetings, campaigning on the issues that he cared about, whether particularly Chile and Salvador Allende. And if he had not been elevated through a combination of accident and political change and social change, being elevated to his position, he would just be that, continuing to speak from the backbenches and the things that he cared about.
Yeah.
But if you can discover that ability to stick at it, I think Labour moderates do have a chance, because I think Labour is much bigger than Corbyn, and it has to be. In its 100-year history, it's gone through all kinds of weird periods when it did very badly, when it was almost in the 80s, it was basically the militant tendency, all that was very embarrassing. The amount of bullying that went on was terrible, maybe on similar scales to what we see now. I think you've just got to recognise that if you're Labour, you've just got to stick at it.
Yeah, but parties do disappear. I mean, we had the Whig Party, which dominated latter 18th and 19th century, and we had the Liberal Party that was in power for how many years? One of the greatest, you know, whereas Gladstone and his followers now.
Yeah.
So it does happen, and maybe that is the sort of transformation we're going through.
But
see where it's coming from.
Non-Tory Britain is going to have
a debate,
a conversation about this, and work out some form of design a vehicle that can take on the Tory party. It's fascinating the response of the Tory liberal conservatives who left over, well, of course some decided to leave over Brexit and some decided to stay. And those who decided to stay, if the election turns out as it appears it's going to at the moment, those people have indicated, because their analysis was, forget the fantasy we talked about earlier of a massive Liberal Democrat breakthrough on the back of Remain. The Tory party has been around for several centuries, and it is this centrifugal force in British life, partly thanks to the voting system, but also because of what it represents in England and the English shires. And it has yet again proved itself to be spectacularly ruthless.
And adaptable.
After the most, and adaptable after the most amazing series of cock-ups in the last three, four years, and was down and out, and does seem as though it's about to win. Can I just ask, but you both, just before we wrap up, what you think of what you think of Boris and how Boris is doing in the campaign? Looks exhausted as far as I can see, but seems to be campaigning
Alistair?
Quite hard.
Give me time to think.
I think they've effectively, well, you said there are the two options for the Tories, really base their campaign on a series of big attacks on the fundamental aspects of the Corbyn project. Like, you know, it's a cipher for a kind of very crude form of Marxism, or it's about it's a institutionally racist project, all the rest. But they've kind of just withdrawn a little bit and said it's about making sure that we have a, which is what Cummings was talking about in his blog yesterday, even though, of course, he'd be delighted we're referencing it.
Bat signal as he sent up, exclamation. Yeah,
but he said, which was interesting, that which I think was the, is, sorry, I'm rambling, but it's the main point of the Tory campaign, and its focal point has been, do you want politics to carry on in the same groove as it has done for the last 3 years? And he said, do you want politics to be on your, on 10 o'clock news in the way it has been every day for the next 3 years with the shenanigans? That's what a hung parliament represents.
Yep.
But for some people that's good, and I can understand why it is good to people who want Brexit to be a more softer in the future relationship, or don't want it to happen at all, or who want the political process to be so extended that something else weird happens. But the fundamental question is, do you want the dynamic to continue? Most people are fed up with it and probably want it to stop. And
it was brilliantly put. And and Boris is he's that personified, isn't he?
Exactly.
That instinct.
Which is why it's, let's close this down, get Brexit done, and get on with the other things. Very quickly, in answer to your question, Ian, which I'll probably muddle through too, is I think the more he gets out in the marginal seats and goes and sees the blue collar working, you know, talks, the better, because I think people do like him, and he is a man of the people in that sense. So there's that side of him, and that's clearly what they're doing, isn't it?
Yep.
Getting him out. And there are a lot of really very good young female Tory candidates, actually, who are sort of joining in that, quite a fresh approach. So there's that, which I think is great. I'm not sure the Andrew Marr, whether he appears, matters to the actual twist of the vote. But at the same time, I think he needs to be not aggressive, but I don't like the defensiveness of a lot of the attacks or the response to the attacks. So going back to the NHS, you know, I'm not saying he should sort of sit there and write it in blood, but he'll just say he should be more aggressive. Say, why would we want to sell it? That's what I want you guys to tell me. Why is the greatest thing? Blah blah blah. You know, give us the more aggressive, and also on his own, which I think is going to come up, his private life and on what he's written.
Yeah.
So the burkas, the letterboxes, the pickaninnies. He's also got to be more defensive, because the whole point of that article he wrote about women looking like letterboxes or bank robbers was that he was defending the right of anyone in Britain to wear whatever they liked, because and it was following on because Denmark had just banned it. Denmark, Sweden, France have all banned the burqa. His entire article was saying why we should not ban it in Britain, and even if people want to look like a letterbox, they should be allowed to.
It's tough to explain
that,
isn't it?
I know.
And
maybe it's me, I like to be sort of very factual, and I can't bear people the innuendo. But maybe it is difficult. But I think he needs to set the record straight.
The one that emerged today,
yeah,
is emerged. It's probably in the collected articles of Boris Johnson. lend me your ears or whatever it's called.
It's called Have I Got Views.
Got it at home. I've never read it.
Have I Got Views for You?
Is it? Yeah. Is that what it's called?
I think there are several. Lots
of, Have I Got Views? Okay.
I mean, it's written millions of words. Yeah. The one today from the mid-90s, yeah, about feckless,
oh yeah,
single mothers and yeah, working class people, it's pretty difficult to defend.
Yeah.
You can see that it's hastily written. I went back and read the whole thing. Helen Lewis made a very good point. Helen Lewis, formerly of the New Statesman, now the Atlantic, that when he was up against it, I obviously couldn't think of anything to write. His default position, when he wasn't just writing a sort of shaggy dog story about Gussie Fink Nottle or something, would be to a rising opinion of the moment, like aren't you sick to death of, with a few twists and a little bit of P.G. Woodhouse thrown in. Mm. And that's a sort of, will this do, Boris?
Yeah.
Boris Collins, and he's written quite a lot of those in the last 25 years. I mean, I don't think.
So what do you think? I don't think it
matters this
him?
Time. I don't think it matters this time, because I think with the voters he's trying to hit, there is just a settled view that, well, the media always go on about this stuff. He's the guy that's trying to get it done.
Yeah.
Give him a chance at trying to get this nonsense resolved, and then sort of move on, and we'll all have Christmas and forget about it. I think that is the settled view of most of the people that are voting for him. There are some genuinely enthusiastic, very pro-Boris people, and particularly among blue-collar voters, who identify him as being somehow on their side. I'm not sure what...
Anti-PC, that's what John McTernan's argument about.
Yeah.
For Boris, anti-PC.
Yeah.
So that was John McTernan, who was a strategist, and, well, he worked in New Labour and all sorts of things, but he wrote an article for us saying the argument for Boris during the leadership race was because he kind of embodies an anti-PC ethic.
Yeah.
Say we like,
which they quite like.
You know, and if you know, I mean, for example, on the, it's a horrible series of words, but Piccaninny and Watermelon Smile was used to take the piss out of aid liberalism that does treat people in effectively a near colonial light.
Yeah.
So it was actually a criticism which is vastly at home on the left, even though that sounds silly.
Same like the Burkas. Yeah. You know, he just uses these colourful expressions because he's wanted to show that he was a lyrical writer. I mean, he's not a racist man. Yeah.
There's brilliant left-wing critiques of the aid industry that effectively replay that. And it's just, I think, but he's just, it's this effluence and this peripatetic rhythm, and it's very journalistic. And I remember writing an article about whether Boris the journalist would suit being PM, because he's used to the thrill of just diving into something and throwing everything at it and using all kinds of funny words, and that served him sort of well for a long time. But whether it was as PM, it would, the dynamic, that kind of energy would work, and it, you know,
he's tamed himself, I think.
Yeah,
sort of has. You know,
he's kept
himself
under control.
Well, we're going to see whether it works. So I think we're going to wrap things up there. So fast forward to next week, where we'll be discussing how the Tory poll narrowed to 3 points.
Reaction.
Andrew Neil and Andrew Marr have been found in a ditch somewhere,
exactly,
with sticking pins in them.
Exactly, and we'll have a sponsored message from the Politburo or something. I don't know. Yeah, so we'll be back in about a week's time. We'll try and do a shorter, rapid reaction podcast as things unfold as well, Alistair. But if you're not reaction subscriber, go to the, but you like what you hear, go to the website www.reaction.life. you can become a subscriber, you get my weekly newsletter, you get all of the brilliant writing by Maggie, Alistair, the team, and lots more, invitations to our events and all that sort of thing. So become a reaction subscriber, and until next time, thank you very much for listening.